Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an article in The Atlantic warning of a coming mental health crisis as the coronavirus has laid bare the failings of American healthcare and public health. Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University, whose latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, a psychiatrist analyzes the age of Trump, joins us to discuss the collective madness of a country not obeying the doctor's orders while people flock to the beaches as Trump panders to the evangelicals, ordering the country's churches opened. We will explore the growing divide in America between reality TV and reality itself, as our make-believe president who watches TV most of the working day finds himself in a desperate war against the truth as the bodies mount in a very real crisis he has utterly failed to handle in violation of his oath to protect and defend the United States. Yet in spite of his increasingly outrageous claims and more blatant lies, much of the country chooses to share in the hucksterism of Trump's magical thinking and blame-shifting as the buck is passed to everyone but the hollow man in charge who only cares about himself and his manufactured tabloid image, which is crumbling before our eyes. Without television, there would be no Donald Trump. And with the country and its citizens at the mercy of Trump's sanity failing the test of reality, we are left to question the sanity of as many as 40% of our fellow Americans who voted for this man and might vote for him again in November. Then, while it seems we are all on this sinking ship of fools, a few are drinking champagne in the lifeboats, having profited obscenely from Trump's misrule, as the nation's billionaires see their net worth shoot up $434 billion between March 18 and May 19. Frank Clemente, executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness, who is the lead author of their new study, Tale of Two Crises, Billionaires Gain as Workers Feel Pandemic Pain, joins us to discuss the data from Forbes showing how the net worth of the U.S.'s 600 billionaires rose 15% during the same period, when almost 40 million Americans lost jobs and over 1.5 million got COVID, with over 100,000 dying from it. Then finally, we'll examine the COVID-19 Global Solidarity Manifesto announced yesterday with one of its signatories, Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He joins us to discuss the rise of global activism and the manifesto, which states, quote, "In a world where the gap between rich and poor is obscene, with the world's richest 1% having more than twice the wealth of the 6.9 billion people, a fundamental redistribution of wealth and power globally and within nations is imperative. Every human being must have the opportunity to live a healthy, creative, and fulfilling life, free from the ravages of poverty, exploitation, and domination." And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Dr. Alan Francis, who is Professor Emeritus and former Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Dr. Francis. And there's an article at The Atlantic, co-authored by Norm Ornstein, Benjamin Miller, and Kavita Patel, "The Coming Mental Health Crisis, Congress Must Rethink the American Approach to Mental Health Care During the Pandemic." And it takes the position that even before the COVID-19 crisis, America's infrastructure for mental health and addiction services was fragmented, overburdened, and underfunded. And the coronavirus has put more stress on that broken system. So in terms of your work, Dr. Francis, Do you see the U.S. reaching a breaking point in terms of mental health?
We were in a breaking point before. Now it's kind of a dead zone. No one's calculated exactly what percentage of the 100 to 150,000 people who already have died from COVID, what percentage are mentally ill. But it's likely to be a high percentage because the hotspots have occurred exactly where the mentally ill live, in hospitals, nursing homes, prisons, shelters, group homes, and very much on the street because about 250,000 of them are homeless. So it's going to turn out, my guess is that we're going to have somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Americans killed by this virus, most of them completely avoidable deaths if we had a sensible country and a sensible leader. That a very large percentage of those individuals, hundreds of thousands maybe, of Americans with severe mental illness will wind up being killed, most of them unnecessarily, by this pandemic.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the president doesn't necessarily care about homeless people, people in prison, or even expendable people in nursing homes, and particularly workers in meatpacking plants, etc., where he's deliberately put their lives at risk without giving them any protection and giving the companies liability, which is why the next tranche of money to help the 40 million unemployed Americans is being held up by Mitch McConnell because he wants to give corporations immunity. That's his top priority. So this is a really cruel exhibition of the worst of America in my mind. You do see, though, people cooperating, people being decent to each other, people exhibiting civility, which is the last thing a president has. So it's a mixed bag, is it not?
Well, I think the really bizarre thing he's doing, the enormous gamble he's now making, is encouraging those who support him the most to do the very things that are most likely to get them sick. So the states that have been Trump states are the ones that are opening up the fastest and the most recklessly. They generally are still in the upswing of the first wave, and opening up at this point is very likely to result in catastrophe to the very people who support Trump the most. The latest is the instigation of people going to church. The virus does not hear prayers and doesn't answer them. From the virus's point of view, a large church gathering is sort of like a free lunch where it can spread from person to person. We've already had a number of the epicenters, the first hotspots, be amongst people of religion attending services. And what he's inviting with the instigation that all states allow church going to be seen as an essential service, bowing to the leaders of the evangelical movement, what he's doing is directly putting the people who have supported him the most loyally, putting them at the greatest risk. And they will be the individuals who spread this virus all through Trump country. So it's not just his indifference. It's not just indifference to others who he doesn't care about because they don't vote for him. It's an indifference to the safety of the people who have put him in office.
And of course, in a church, if you start singing, I imagine that even spreads the virus. It's airborne. And latest studies indicate that people don't necessarily get it from surfaces, but rather from droplets in the air. So does this lead us, though, Dr. Alan Francis, to a broader kind of perspective on the twilight of American sanity, the title of your book, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump? Your book wasn't just about the idea that Trump is mentally ill, but it almost suggests in at least a percentage of the American people are mentally ill in as much as they share the delusions that Trump propagates on a daily basis. In this country at the moment, we are divided, but we are divided between reality television and reality. Trump doles out a daily dose of reality TV stunts to distract people from the fact that he doesn't have a clue about what he's doing. But he's successful so far at keeping changing the subject. He gets the press following every little rabbit hole, shiny light that he dangles in front of them. And he's got 40% of the country at least locked in this daily delusion that he doles out. And then on the other side, you've got reality. You've got 100,000 dead Americans, more likely to be 125,000 at least, and it's getting worse and worse. And now he's making it worse by forcing the country to open up prematurely because all he cares about is getting re-elected. So I literally am tearing my hair out thinking, you know, am I crazy or are the rest of them crazy? Is there a point, a critical mass, where we'll either be a country of insane dupes or a country of sober adults?
Well, Ian, you're like the Greek legend of Cassandra. She was gifted at birth with the ability to see the future and cursed at birth because no one would listen to her when she tried to warn them about its risks. And that's exactly the position you and I guess I and many of us are in. What I say over and over again is that Trump isn't crazy. He's a con man. He's a crook. He's a callous user of other people, an exploiter, a self-promoter. We're crazy as a country for having elected him and for letting him get this far. If Trump dies of coronavirus tomorrow or has a arrhythmia from chloroquine tomorrow and leaves the scene, that doesn't immediately cure America of the worst pandemic of disinformation and polarization and hatred that he's represented. But I think we have to be very clear that Trump is the symptom of our distress and our disease. He's not the cause, and he's certainly not the underlying problem. And for the past 50 years, there's been a very concerted, highly successful, very slickly done con game played on the American people, with the rich and powerful taking over the means of communication that the many of the individuals who are least served by the Republican Party most watch. So I blame Rupert Murdoch in a way much more than I do Trump. I blame the Koch brothers, the Mercers, the billionaire class that has used Trump as its stalking horse and as its con man and as its front. I blame them more because they've corrupted the whole process of an informed citizenry that's absolutely necessary for democracy. And if we have a broadcast medium that dominates the airwaves in Fox News, the TV airwaves, if we have a talk show radio industry that's geared towards peddling conspiracy theories and extreme right wing nut ideas. It's the internet. There's a really horrible story NPR gave that 45% of the information going out about the virus on the internet is done by bots, many of them Chinese or Russian, and some of them probably by local vax groups and anti-vax groups and weird white-wing conspiracy theories. So the information people are getting on the internet about the pandemic isn't coming from the medical professionals who understand how best to meet it. It's coming from a coordinated effort to disinformation and to create tension within the country. I recently read about an emergency room doctor whose patient became furious at him when told that he was positive for COVID. Patients possibly dying from multi-organ failure and claims to the doctor in an angry way, there is no COVID, that COVID's a myth. COVID's a libtard myth, as he needs treatment for it because he may possibly die from it. So all in all, the short answer to your question is that Trump is an absolute sort of antichrist danger to democracy, and I think we'll wind up killing 500,000 or more Americans, most of them unnecessarily. But he's only the symptom, and unless we somehow figure out a way to get back to the country that elected Obama, seems like forever ago, but it was really only 12 years ago. Unless we get back to a country that has a rational mindset and has a heart filled with compassion for others and a sense of unity, unless we do that, I see this as a sort of tipping point. I think if he's reelected, that the impact he can have in twisting the court system, in diminishing the role of Congress, and getting rid of all oversight over his actions, that it will have been a coup, and the conspiracy theorists who are governed by the billionaires will have won.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Alan Francis, why would Murdoch and Mercer and the Kochs want to live in a country that is hollowed out, weakened, with millions and millions added to the underclass, and on the global stage, a weakened country in a world where Trump has empowered criminals and kleptocrats like Putin and Xi Jinping and Erdogan and Orban and the sorry mix of pals that he has out there in the world of wannabe despots. This country is being weakened at warp speed. Why would they want to live in a country like that? Why would they want to accelerate the end of the American dream?
I think one of the problems of people like you and I have is it's almost impossible to empathize with the people who think differently with us in this regard. We might be able to empathize with lots of different individuals in different ways, but it's very hard to empathize with a greedy billionaire, especially the old ones who are about to die. Why would they create a world like this? Why would they want to hand it down to their children and their grandchildren? The initial ideological force behind the current movement was the John Birch Society, which started in the 50s. And it was self-consciously intended to create a kind of aristocracy governed by the billionaire class and to, in one way or another, successfully reduce the power of everyone else to influence the course of affairs. And part of the anti-union, the successful anti-union movement, the union busting of the last, ever since before Reagan, but especially since 1980 with Reagan, has been to reduce the power of the weak to influence the actions of the strong. It's very hard to read Ayn Rand. She's a terrible writer with horrible values. But if you want to understand the ethos or lack of ethics that governs the actions of the greedy class, you need to read her books, because in effect they're a rationalization for being selfish. There's a great deal of what the Republicans have accomplished in this profound propaganda movement over the course of the last 60 years or so, is to justify to the poor that their enemy is based on racial or religious or gender difference rather than through economic and class difference. And to justify to the rich that it's okay for them to be as selfish as they possibly want to be without regard for everyone else. And it's not just the right-wingers. I mean, take Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world, has at least, I think, about $110 billion. It's gone up a lot with Amazon's success in the pandemic. And yet he won't give a living wage to his workers. He won't make sure that the warehouses are clean. That the weirdness of people who aren't satisfied with $100 billion is something we may never understand, but we have to learn to deal with it.
Well, we're going to be dealing with that very issue in the next segment, Dr. Alan Francis. So I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Ian, I think that you, as discouraged as you sometimes get, and as I sometimes get, I think that what we have to do is our very best to convey true information to fight the fake news. And I think that the listeners today, the major message has to be, take care of yourselves and your family members. Don't believe that the country can open up painlessly now, that this is a virus that will probably last for another year or more as an imminent threat. And unless you protect yourself and your family, you're very likely to get sick and to cause sickness in a way that later you will regret.
Well, Dr. Alan Francis, I thank you again. And Dr. Alan Francis is Professor Emeritus and former Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference works Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the net worth of the U.S.'s 600 billionaires rose 15% during the same period when almost 40 million Americans lost jobs and over 1.5 million got COVID, with over 100,000 dying from it. This is not the land of milk and honey. This is a place where people sell their souls out for money. You know they do. They all wanna see just what you're gonna do. Don't commit suicide. You gotta keep on going. Hey, Pa, get
ready to call. Just like Humpty Dumpty, I'm going to fall. And I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along, yes, rolling along. Don't want any million, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, just one, that's all I can wear. A bundle of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Frank Clementi, his executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations. And he's also been a senior policy advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations. And he's the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Tale of Two Crises, Billionaires Gain as Workers Feel Pandemic Pain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Clementi.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thank you. And your study covers the time between March the 18th and May the 19th. And that's roughly when the pandemic shutdown began and when most federal and state economic restrictions were put in place. And the total, during that period, the total net worth of the 600 plus U.S. billionaires jumped from $434 billion, or 15%, based on the group's analysis of Forbes data. So the billionaires' worth rose from $2.948 trillion to $3.382 trillion. And in contrast, during the same approximate period, more than 38.5 million working Americans lost their jobs. 1.5 million Americans fell ill, and the virus has claimed about 100,000 lives. And if it were properly counted, it'd probably be more like 125,000 lives. So that is just an absolutely devastating contrast. I mean, this is extraordinary. So what mechanism is out there that would allow billionaires to gain while average Americans feel the pain?
Well, most of these people, their wealth is in the businesses that they own or that they've got huge stakes in. Elon Musk at Tesla, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, Jeff Bezos at Amazon. And most wealth in this country is not generated. People don't accumulate their wealth through salaries and profit and wages like average working Americans do. They accumulate wealth through the increase in the stock value, the increase in value overall of their business. And by the way, most of that goes untaxed. It's only taxed once they sell it. So these folks are, these are companies. A lot of them are high-tech companies. If you look at the data, the biggest increase in wealth has been in the high-tech sector. Some of these big increases are related to, obviously, the pandemic. I mean, as we know, Amazon is, my wife said she had 60 orders on our credit card last month through Amazon. I hate to admit that. I don't buy Amazon. She does. Facebook, so many people are at home these days, and so they're online web surfing on their Facebook pages, and so advertising dollars have gone up greatly there. So the wealth is accumulated because they own vast chunks of these businesses, and honestly, some of it is way overblown, like Tesla. Their stock value is jacked up. A lot of people, a lot of investors don't have places to park their money these days during this pandemic. The bond market's way down, so it's not worth putting money into bonds right now. Stock market, it's not worth putting money into real estate right now. Heck, who knows how many people are going to be going back to offices in the future. Home sales are down, so a lot of people are just putting their money in the stock market. And I would say it's inflating the value of stocks, and that's why a lot of these people, their wealth is soaring so much.
Well, some of them on the list, I mean, you're right, obviously most of them of the top billionaires who Bezos' wealth went from $113 billion to $147 billion, up 34.6 billion just in this period from March 18th to May 19th. And then Bill Gates, another tech billionaire, his went up by 8 billion. Mark Zuckerberg's wealth went up by 25 billion. And then the only sort of outlier who's not in the tech world, Warren Buffett, his wealth went up rather modestly, less than 1%, still astronomical. And then Larry Ellison, another tech guy, his wealth went up about 12%. One of the people on the list, Michael Bloomberg, his wealth went up 25%. And I would have thought after all the money he wasted on running for president, that pretty amazing.
Well, remember, he spent less than $1 billion on his campaign, so he replenished those coffers and then some. I hate to laugh. I mean, geez.
Right.
He went from $48 billion to $60 billion, a 26% increase in his wealth in 2 months' time. I mean, what can I say?
Sure.
This is just astonishing stuff. The thing that bothers me most in some ways is the Bezos numbers. The 30% growth in his wealth. Amazon profits are huge. The wealth has been fantastic since the pandemic hit. But this is a company, remember, that still doesn't pay any taxes. In 2018, after the Trump tax cuts passed, it paid zero. It actually got a tax refund from the government. It was tooting its horn last year because I think it paid like a million or two in taxes. Like 1% of its profit it paid in taxes last year. And we think it's on track to pay nothing again this year. That's because one of the big loopholes that was in the Trump tax cuts the past couple of years ago, basically any investment that a company makes this year or any given year, it can write off the cost of those investments right away. It used to be you had to write those costs off over 10 or 12, 20 years, depending on the life of the asset. This loophole allows them to write it off immediately, and so they can take these big write-offs when they're making a lot of money. So I'm not expecting him to pay a lot.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Clementi, the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strength and Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations. He's also been a senior policy advisor to the United States House Committee on Government Operations and is the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Tale of Two Crises, Billionaires Gain as Workers Feel Pandemic Pain. Now, just to finish up on the list of the billionaires, you've got the three Waltons, the owners of Walmart, or the heirs to Walmart, Jim Walton, Alice Walton, and Rob Walton. Together, their fortunes are $165 billion. So they, as a family, they're probably the richest, even collectively richer than Bezos. And that's an extraordinary windfall, isn't it, for inheriting something?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty from the point of view of the rich of wealth. It gets passed on. And remember, most people don't even realize, people think we have an estate tax. We do have an estate tax, but they think that, when Sam Walton passed on his estate to his children, that it was taxed at a 40% rate. It does not happen at this lofty end of the income spectrum. These folks basically get these stocks passed on to them tax free. Those stocks are, in terms of a rich person passing their wealth on, their stocks on, their ownership in a business to the next person in the generation down below, it is not taxed when it gets passed on. It is only taxed when it is sold. And so Bezos could pass on his $150 billion in wealth. He could pass on his kids today, or when he died, it could pass on to his kids, and it would not be taxed. They would get that business at the new value. They wouldn't get it at the value that it was when Bezos started the business, and then they get it, and then it gets taxed on that. They would get it at the new value of $150 billion. All the taxes that could have been collected from zero to $150 billion don't get collected. And it gets passed on essentially tax-free to the family members. And they only pay taxes on it when they sell it, and they only pay taxes on it from the new value, the basis value that they inherited it at. So if they inherited it at $150 billion, that becomes the new basis by which they pay taxes. Any increase in wealth going forward. So they're not paying taxes on $150 billion. They're only paying taxes on the extra money that gets put on top of the $150 billion. And they only pay taxes on that when it's sold. They're not paying taxes all along like the rest of us pay taxes all with every paycheck.
Well, Bezos's ex-wife, Mackenzie Bezos, is on the list. She's just below the Waltons.
Right.
Her net worth went from $36 billion to $48 billion. That's up $12 billion. The one person on this list who I think has got as much blood on his hands as Donald Trump has, with 100,000 dead Americans, and at least half of those can attribute to Trump's delay in putting in the mitigation that his public health officials were begging him to do. The person that I think is really driving so much of this insanity in this country and endangering the lives of billions of Americans is Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox News. His wealth went from $14.9 billion to $16.9 billion, up $2 billion just in this same period from March 18th to May 19th. So certainly, to my mind, he's the least deserving and possibly the most responsible for much of this, because Trump couldn't operate without Murdoch's propaganda machine, Fox News, and the right-wing echo chamber. And they're the ones that are beating the drum. And no matter how crazy Trump's statements are, they deny them. And somehow they've got, who knows, 40% of the American people locked in this bubble of delusion that this reality TV huckster actually knows what he's doing. I mean, we are in a country that's divided between this reality TV soap opera that's turning into a farce and a tragedy. At the same time, we have reality at war with reality TV. 40% of the country is locked in this reality TV bubble, and they can't see that this is a massive hoax. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. It's so obvious. I mean, I'm tearing my hair out here because I don't understand how we could be such a divided nation between sentient people and people, you know, seduced into a delusion.
Yeah, well, certainly Murdoch's 14% increase in his wealth shows that it pays to engage in propaganda and falsehoods and outright lies and essentially be a mouthpiece for the president, or to have the president follow your lead. As we know, Fox puts up false, crazy, I think the whole Obamagate fraud that is being propagated on the public at this point in time by Trump started with the Fox News network. And, you know, it's not just Fox. I mean, he's got other properties, like New York Post, where he's able to put his propaganda out, too. So these, you know, the capitalist system works great for a lot of people from various sides here.
Well, what's your sense then, just in the last few minutes, Frank Lametti, about whether the report, is it going to move the needle?
We've got a great opportunity right now. People may or may not be aware of a thing called the Millionaire's Giveaway. It was a huge tax break that was in the CARES Act. If folks remember, the CARES Act is the $2 trillion program that passed at the end of March for frontline workers, for the unemployment compensation boost folks got, the small business loans, et cetera. Buried in there was a provision that almost exclusively benefits millionaires. 43,000 millionaires are getting an average tax break of $1.6 million this year alone because of this loophole that was in the CARES Act. We knew it was in there, but we didn't know how bad it was, how skewed it was to the rich. And so we worked with the House, Nancy Pelosi and the House members to get inserted into the HEROES Act. That's the new proposal that passed the House last week. That's a $3 trillion package for more fiscal relief for states, local government services, et cetera. So we got the repeal of this provision in there. And not only is it a repeal of the temporary provision, but it's a permanent repeal, and it will raise $250 billion. So about 10% of the cost of that new HEROES Act is going to come from about 43,000 millionaires. We need to keep that in. We need to have that in the bill that gets passed ultimately between the House and the Senate. So the fight right now is over in the Senate, trying to get McConnell to agree to a big revenue number that would aid workers, families, state and local governments for keep our services running, but also to get rid of this loophole and to make sure that there's no new business corporate tax cuts in that program. The corporate lobby and Trump are both lined up big time trying to get more tax breaks for the rich and corporations into this next COVID-19 financial aid bill. So that's where the fight is. Your listeners, I think, are mostly California. Senator Dianne Feinstein is not on a bill to repeal this, but sponsored by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse out of Rhode Island. Senator Kamala Harris is on the bill. She's a co-sponsor. We've got 24 senators that are co-sponsoring this bill. We need to win on that one. That's a way to pay for a lot of this, and it's a way to take money out of 43,000 millionaires' hands.
Well, just in closing, it seems extraordinary that the Democrats, I don't know whether they noticed this giveaway in the CARES Act or whether they were overridden. Mnuchin obviously is doing the bidding of the wealthy. He's the worst kind of vulture capitalist one could imagine. But all that McConnell cares about now is giving immunity to corporations like the meatpacking plants who are forcing their workers to come back and risk their lives without giving them proper protections. That's where his priorities are. So there's a real battle ahead.
There is. Well, you know, I want to just say that the reason we did not know so much about this loophole was this is how business is being done in Washington lately. The bill passed the House, passed the Senate, where it originated by McConnell and Chuck Grassley at Iowa, without a score. In other words, we didn't know how much this tax loophole was going to cost. Not only that, it took 2 weeks to find out who was benefiting from this tax loophole. We thought it would be a small number. We didn't think it would be a small number of folks. But part of the problem was the way the sausage is made here in Washington and the rush job to get this thing done, which was understandable given the crisis we were facing. But we didn't know the true cost, and we didn't know the true winners in this thing until much later.
Well, Frank Lametti, I'm very grateful that you've pointed this out to us, and I thank you for joining us.
Cheers. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Frank Lametti, as the Executive Director and Co-Founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was Campaign Manager for the Strength and Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations. He's also been a Senior Policy Advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations, and he's the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Tale of Two Crises, Billionaires Gain as Workers Feel Pandemic Pain. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the rise of global activism and the COVID-19 Global Solidarity Manifesto.
That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry unable, protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Kuznick, who is Professor of History and Director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. His books include Beyond the Laboratory, Scientists as Political Activists in 1930s America, and Rethinking the Atomic Bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives. And he is the co-author of the book and the documentary series available at Netflix, The Untold History of the United States. And he is a signatory to the new COVID-19 Global Solidarity Coalition Manifesto. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Kuznick.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the COVID-19 Global Solidarity Coalition was launched yesterday, and it calls upon the global community to rethink the self-destructive path that humanity is presently following, as demonstrated by the devastation and the continuing threat of the COVID-19 pandemic, the existential threats of climate change and nuclear war, the waste of lives and resources due to the ongoing warfare and unbridled militarism, and the deplorable living conditions that billions of our sisters and brothers face daily. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary paradox. We were just in the previous segment talking about how the richest of the rich on this planet have become even richer during this pandemic. But, for example, the country of Italy, it looks as though its economy will be totally devastated. So if a first world economy is devastated, one can imagine what is happening in the rest of the world. So this is a real challenge, but in every crisis there is an opportunity. So how do you see it, Peter?
I see it very much the way you've laid it out. This is a tragedy, it's a crisis, but it's also an opportunity. If you think that before this crisis began, we already were in a situation in which the richest 8 people in the world had more wealth than the poorest 3.8 billion people. Even in the United States, wealthy United States, the richest 3 people had more wealth than the bottom half of the population. You know, it becomes clear what it means when we talk about the fact that most people live paycheck to paycheck. And this is a kind of a crisis. We see how disproportionately it's sickening and killing people of color, people who are impoverished, people that don't have the means and resources. So we have to begin. What we're trying to do with this manifesto and this coalition is get beyond treating just the symptoms. Yeah, we have to treat the symptoms, and we have to do that on a local basis and a national basis. But what we're trying to point out is the deep underlying structural problems. What we talk about in our opening line of our manifesto, the urgency of changing global structures of inequity and violence. What we're seeing is 40 years of neoliberal economic policies that have basically plundered the earth. We've plundered the resources. We've destroyed the rainforests. We've created, as you say, these existential threats. The pandemic is potentially an existential threat, or future ones could be. But also, we've got the global warming. We've got the nuclear crisis. And we look again, just this past week, the United States abrogated the Open Skies Treaty. If we look at the architecture of arms control, and especially nuclear arms control, we've been disrupting this entirely. We're beginning in 2002 with the U.S. pulling out of the ABM Treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Then the United States pulling out of the nuclear deal with Iran, the JCPOA. Then the United States abrogating the INF Treaty. Now the new Open Skies Treaty. The only thing that's really left now is the New START Treaty. The New START Treaty expires February of 2021. Putin has asked the United States to extend this. This limits the number of nuclear weapons and the number of delivery systems. So it creates a certain constraints upon the nuclear arms race. Right now, there are about 14,000 nuclear weapons in the world. Or deployed nuclear weapons. If the New START Treaty goes down, and Trump has said that he doesn't like it and he doesn't want to renew it, what we're facing then is nuclear anarchy. We could get back to the kind of nuclear arms race we had in the 1980s when there were 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, when we had accumulated the equivalent of 1.5 million Hiroshima bombs. That kind of insanity. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has moved the hands of the doomsday clock now to 100 seconds before midnight. The closest it's ever been before this was in 1953, when we moved it to 2 minutes before midnight after the U.S. and the Soviet Union tested their hydrogen bombs, and then it was moved back to 2 minutes before midnight in January 2018. Well, now we're actually even closer than that. So, and you see what's happening with the heightened enmity between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and China, the Trump administration's new Cold War policies toward China, containment policy toward China. Instead of dealing with the deep underlying global issues that confront people across the planet, we're instead getting involved in this kind of, again, geopolitical, nationalist kind of conflict and competition. For example, why shouldn't we not be working collectively to deal with, to find a vaccine for this coronavirus? But instead, we're turning this into a national competition. The U.S. is defunding the World Health Organization, and the U.S. is in a competition with other countries to come up with this virus. It doesn't make any sense. If Kennedy could say in September of 63, 2 months before his assassination, that talk about his signature initiative, the space race, and saying it doesn't make any sense for this effort to go to the moon to be a matter of national competition. So why shouldn't we and the Soviets work together with the rest of humanity to make this a mission in the interest of all of us? And that same kind of thinking needs to apply. And that's what we're trying to do with this global manifesto that we're advocating.
And of course, you can add to the damage that Trump is doing to what's left of nuclear arms control treaties, particularly between the U.S. and Russia. He apparently wants to also get out of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and start testing nuclear weapons, which would be totally devastating and not only probably be the last straw for any possibility of controlling nuclear weapons, it would also add to the global pollution, etc. So, you know, the sad thing is that most scenarios that suggest how we may see a nuclear weapon fired in anger, and none have been fired in anger since Nagasaki, might be on the Indian subcontinent between India and Pakistan. Pakistan is the fastest growing nuclear arsenal on the planet, and this is a very unstable country with the government essentially blackmailing the world, saying, you know, you have to support us, otherwise the jihadis are going to take over the nukes. So that's a pretty intolerable situation too. If there was global cooperation between the U.S. and Russia, and in particular between the U.S. and China, maybe we could restrain Pakistan and India, but I don't see that happening.
That's a very, very good point. And if you think about what nuclear war between India and Pakistan means, I like to put this in the context of what we know about nuclear winter. And Carl Sagan and other scientists in the 1980s warned us about the effects of nuclear winter. But it looks like from the latest research being done internationally, the threshold that they put was actually too high. The latest estimates are that even a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, in which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, would send so much smoke, soot, and debris into the stratosphere, would encircle the globe within a week or two, 5 million tons up into the stratosphere, block the sun's rays from hitting the Earth, temperatures would plummet across the world, and even that limited nuclear war could lead to up to 2 billion deaths. You think that's 100 nuclear weapons, Hiroshima size. We've got 14,000 still, and they're between 7 and 80 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. But the situation is, you look at, for example, so in January of 2018, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moves the hands of the doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight. That same month, General Mattis, Secretary of Defense, says that America's main national security threat is no longer global terrorism, it's Russia and China. The next month, February 2018, Trump puts out his new nuclear posture review, which elevates the status of nuclear weapons far higher than it had been under Obama, and talks about developing new more usable nuclear weapons. This next month, March 1st, 2018, Vladimir Putin makes his State of the Nation address, and he announces that Russia now has five new nuclear weapons, all of which can circumvent American missile defense systems. And so we see this escalation going on now. And it's not just Trump. Trump, as we know, is totally irresponsible when it comes to this issue. With Trump, he says, what's the point of having nuclear weapons if we can't use them? To most sane people, that means let's get rid of nuclear weapons. To Trump, it means making them more usable. But a lot of this falls on Obama, because it was Obama who announced the 30-year, trillion-dollar modernization program of the entire American nuclear arsenal. That number then jumped to $1.2 trillion. We now estimate it's going to cost at least $1.7 trillion. But it's not just the United States. All nine nuclear powers are now modernizing their arsenals, making their nuclear weapons more efficient and actually more deadly. So we face these kinds of existential threats, and the global warming is becoming more and more serious and more difficult to turn back the more we delay on dealing with these kinds of crises. So, which is why we're trying to look at what are the deep underlying causes for what's going on now. Why is this pandemic so devastating, and where is it most devastating around the world? And we're seeing this. And if we were in bad shape as a global community before this started, we're in much worse shape as a global community now, as you've been pointing out.
Well, Peter Kasnick, it's possible that the COVID-19 pandemic could be the kind of first wave, not that we haven't had SARS and MERS before and others, but the first wave of a really even more deadly pandemic. I mean, as bad as this one is, there's the possibility of more of these viruses doing the zoonotic leap, as it's called, largely because we're tearing down the rainforests to build palm oil plantations. And palm oil, anybody cares about the environment, they should immediately ban palm oil. And you've got also the possibility of bioweapons, and the COVID-19 shows you how devastating a bioweapon could be, although it's insane. I don't know how you'd ever have a bioweapon that would just kill the enemy. I mean, there aren't any borders anymore, are there?
Even the gas warfare, the poison gas used during World War I, was blowing back on the sides that were deploying it. So, yeah, that kind of insanity is what we're confronting now. But even in terms of this pandemic, if you go back to the 1918 so-called Spanish flu pandemic, which was a misnomer, of course, the first wave was relatively mild. It was the second wave that proved so devastating. We estimate that there were anywhere between 20 and 100 million dead from the pandemic in 1918. But it was that second wave that hit in September of 2018 that proved devastating. And then we got hit with a third wave, which wasn't as bad as the second wave, but it was also very devastating. In the U.S. alone, we lost 675,000 people, is the current estimate. So these kind of pandemics, if they're not treated well, but what we've done with this neoliberal economic policy is we've ravaged healthcare across the planet. We've ravaged the kind of support systems, the safety nets that people need. And, you know, Martin Luther King once said, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Well, I think we're not only approaching spiritual death, I think we're approaching actual physical death as we undermine the support systems that are necessary to keep us alive as a global population. And as you say, we're doing so in the interest of this kind of greed, this kind of profit, this idea that that markets should control everything, and that the only thing that people should think in terms of is maximizing profit, and that somehow that's going to work out in the interest of everybody. And what we're seeing now is that it's just the opposite. And this is our chance, because more and more people are seeing it. You know, we see how what happens to somebody in a market in Wuhan, a place that most people had never even heard of before this crisis started, can affect people everywhere on the planet. And we are so interconnected as a global community, and more people are beginning to think as a global community. So it shouldn't be make America great again, make Russia great again, make China great again. You know, this kind of nationalist thinking is so outmoded in an era when it's no longer the same kind of security threats that people thought of even wrongly in the 20th century, early 21st century. What really threatens us now are very, very different kind of problems, and they require different solutions.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute or so, Peter Kuznick, the manifesto ends in a world where the gap between rich and poor is obscene, with the world's richest 1% having more than twice the wealth of 6.9 billion people. A fundamental redistribution of wealth and power globally and within nations is imperative. Every human being must have the opportunity to live a healthy, creative, and fulfilling life, free from the ravages of poverty, exploitation, and domination. So far, it's been a pretty pessimistic scenario we've been portraying here, albeit a realistic one. There are some glimmers that maybe there are changes underway. For example, on the you talk about the neoliberals, the real cheerleaders for unbridled capitalism, the libertarians, for example, are going crazy because suddenly the American people need a government. They are discovering it, that this pandemic is not something that the private sector can deal with. And I think that explains this incredible hostility and all of this impetus to try and open up the economy recklessly when we've just passed the 100,000 mark of deaths in this country, and the accurate figure would be more like 125,000. And people, by and large, in spite of the propaganda from Trump and the Republicans to preemptively and prematurely open up the country, people are being very cautious, and they're treating each other, I think, with respect and understanding. And I've witnessed it, and I think you have too, that there is a kind of civility out there, in spite of our president being the least civil person probably in the entire country. I think there's some signs of hope. What do you think?
I think we see both trends going on, and that's we're at a crossroads right now, because we could go either way. You see those people turning out with their assault weapons to protest and demand the opening up of the various states right now, with Trump egging them on, cheerleading this. So you do see a kind of neo-fascist movement under the guise of liberty and freedom. But as you say, we also see the opposite. We see people, that's what our coalition is about. We've got people from dozens of countries who are seeing this in similar global terms. What we're trying to do is provide a framework for understanding the problems that don't just treat the symptoms, don't just treat the manifestations, but get at the deeper underlying causes of this, because we can't keep on kicking this down the road. We see the consequences. It gets worse, more dangerous, more serious each time. But people are responding. I mean, just had a really nice article this morning in the Jerusalem Post, or yesterday morning, but Jerusalem Post, progressive magazine. It's going out all over the world. And so the more we can do to spread the message, to go to our global solidarity manifesto or globalsolidarity.org website and sign the manifesto, circulate it, and try to bring as many people as possible into this kind of understanding and movement on an international basis that's going to address the real causes of what and the real problems that we face as a species right now, as a global population.
And to sign the manifesto, you go to covidglobalsolidarity.org. And I thank you again for joining us, Peter Kuznick.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Kuznick, who's Professor of History and Director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. His books include Beyond the Laboratory, Scientists as Political Activists in 1930s America, and Rethinking the Atomic Bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives. And he is the co-author of the book and the documentary series available at Netflix, The Untold History of the United States. And he's a signatory to the new COVID-19 Global Solidarity Coalition Manifesto, which is available at covidglobalsolidarity.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pit.